The following recording was made of an issue forum held on Wednesday, October 12, 2022, at the Bozeman Public Safety Center. The forum was sponsored by the Bozeman League of Women Voters, American Association of University Women, Bozeman Professional Women, the Belgrade Community Library, and the Bozeman Public Library, and was moderated by Sally Mason. This is the second part of the forum, a discussion of Legislative Referendum LR 131, Medical Care Requirements for Born Alive Infants Measure, that will be on ballots statewide. This was intended as a forum presenting arguments by proponents and opponents, but the proponents of the measure decided shortly before the event to not participate. Because both proponents and opponents of the measure were invited to participate in a moderated forum, we are airing the forum, although most of the viewpoints and information were presented by opponents. KGVM does not endorse any candidate or take a particular position on any ballot issue. We strive to disseminate available information to help voters make informed decisions.
Originally, this was to be a pro-con, and the pro people at the last minute said they weren't. So, we will have these doctors, will you introduce yourselves and explain what you do, and then will you talk about LR 131, and then we'll have questions.
My name is Katie Dardet, and I'm a pediatrician.
My name is Adrienne Harrigan, and I'm a maternal-fetal medicine doctor.
I'm Lorraine Pettit, and I'm a neonatologist, so a pediatrician who takes care of preterm and sick babies.
And I'm Hillary Ann. I'm with the No on LR 131 campaign. And also, sorry, a small note that I had my flu vaccine, which I'm so grateful for, but I'm feeling deeply under the weather, so thank you all for your grace and your patience with me tonight. If I get foggy, I will find an answer for you when I'm less foggy.
At least you have medical care.
At least medical experts recommended to me.
Anybody want to go first?
Yeah, so I can start us off with the history of LR 131, everyone. And so LR 131 originated during the 2021 Montana legislative session. It was proposed via House Bill 167 by Representative Matt Regeer. He's a representative based up in the Kalispell area. And he put forward a bill that was purported to intend to protect infants who are born alive after an abortion, after induced labor, after natural labor, or after C-section. And so that's different than what we've seen them try to pass in the past. In 2019, former Senator Albert Olszewski tried to pass a similar bill, but he targeted it very specifically at infants born after an abortion. And so we really don't understand why Representative Matt Regeer decided to target families who are dealing with these tragic circumstances, but here we are. And so HB 167 is what led to LR 131, which is a legislative referendum. And so most of you are probably familiar with, you know, there's often a petition process to get something onto a general ballot, but for a legislative referendum, they're able to make the decision up at the state house and then get it on the ballot for the next year. So I think that's a lot of folks are like, where did this come from? They're feeling distrustful of it, but it is a proper scenario that we see pretty often. And so, yeah, that is LR 131 and the history of it. But I'll leave it to our providers to really go into the extremes of the bill. But the top notes are that what it wants to do is take away the private decision-making abilities of families to work with their doctors to decide on appropriate comfort care in the event that they have a non-viable infant who they know will not be able to survive more than a few minutes or hours or days. And as it stands right now, Montana families are able to decide, you know, either I want to proceed with all of these, you know, procedures and treatment methods, or they're able to decide, I want to be able to hold my infant as they pass away. I want to be able to bring in my pastor to baptize my infant. I want to bring in their siblings to meet them, their grandmother to meet them. And so those are all decisions that are available to Montana families right now. And LR 131 would take that away. While proposing nothing new, it doesn't solve any existing problems. A lot of folks, you know, will read the ballot language and say, like, oh, well, it's saying that, you know, we're doing this to protect babies who are born in these, you know, terrible circumstances. And to that, I would say that we already have that state law. It is Montana Code Annotated 5020108. And then, of course, we also have federal law. And then, yeah, plenty of protection. So This does nothing new for Montanans. It only takes away from Montanans.
And so a lot of people don't know what a maternal fetal medicine doctor does. So I am a physician that did an OBGYN residency and then did 3 additional years in essentially fetal diagnosis and also taking care of high-risk mothers that have other medical conditions that may make their pregnancies more high-risk. And so, day-to-day in my job, a lot of times I'm doing ultrasounds and I'm telling parents, you know, your baby looks great, nothing to do. But, you know, at least once or twice a day, I'm delivering pretty devastating news to parents saying, you know, your baby has a what we consider lethal chromosomal abnormality, like trisomy 13 or 18, or, you know, your baby has what we consider to be a lethal, you know, birth defect, like the brain has not developed appropriately, or they have a heart defect that would essentially subject a child to having multiple surgeries that may still not result in survival. And so for those parents, you know, I do a lot of anticipatory counseling, you know, talking to them about what it would look like if they carried their baby to term, what it would look like if they decided to terminate their pregnancy. And I work really closely with providers like Dr. Pettit so that we can kind of make that a decision that parents are able to live with and feel comfortable with. And so I think that this bill or this initiative is going to really make that counseling that much harder, because I'm not going to be able to say, you know, once your baby's born, you'll be able to spend time with your baby. The chaplain can come in and spend time with you. It's, you know, we are now legally obligated to provide, you know, life-sustaining measures for your baby, which can mean providing painful procedures to a baby that would not survive otherwise, because, you know, I get consults multiple times a month for babies that are going to be born at 18, 19, 20 weeks, and no matter what we do for those babies, we don't have the science, we don't have the technology to make them live. And even though that's like heartbreaking, it's just the way that it is. And I want those parents to be able to experience the comfort of being able to be with their babies. And I think that all of us would feel that same way. And we don't want to be criminalized for doing what's compassionate for parents and their babies. So I think that that is, you know, from an obstetrical standpoint, you know, I oftentimes deliver this devastating news and I have to tell them what the next step is. I don't personally take care of the babies once they're born. But one of the things that I fear would come as a result of this bill or this, you know, law essentially would be that, you know, I think the people that wrote this had the intent of trying to make it harder to get abortions in Montana. But I think that this would actually increase the abortion rate for our patients, because they wouldn't have that option to be in with their baby or to provide comfort for their baby. And so if they know that their baby is going to be subjected to medical procedures, they may opt instead to terminate the pregnancy. So I think it's actually potentially going to have the opposite effect that they had intended. I also, I think it's going to make our pediatricians leave the state. Mm-hmm. They are not going to want to practice here. You know, I think we all took this Hippocratic oath to do no harm and to provide, you know, ethical, compassionate, evidence-based care to our patients. And that's taking that away from us. We're not able to do it in a way that is private, so that it's a patient and family decision in conjunction with their, you know, medical team. It now becomes something that we have to bring the government into, which I think, you know, they don't have the training, they don't understand the situation. And I think it makes it incredibly hard to want to stay in practice in Montana.
I'm Lorraine Pettit. I am a neonatal physician, so I do take care of these sick and preterm babies after they're born. And if this law passes, it would make it impossible to practice neonatology in the state of Montana. It is not medically ethical to provide painful procedures or to intervene or to take a baby away from a parent if I know that that care is futile and is only going to cause pain and suffering for the baby, for the family, and for the entire healthcare team. That is not what I will do. I will either leave the state or I will risk being charged with a felony. Now, if we don't know, there are certainly circumstances where the viability of the baby is in question. We don't know for sure what the outcome's going to be. And that's when you need your medical experts. You talk to the family and you talk about, you decide what's in the baby's best interest. It's not something that can be legislated. And parents, in consultation with their providers, need to decide what's in the best interest for their babies. And I do think that Matt Regeer intends to, for us to provide futile care. He says that this is very straightforward, that it's better to be alive in the ICU than it is to be dead. Most people don't believe that. that our government wants to impose their values on us, and that's just not acceptable. So if you want to be able to make private choices about your health care, vote no on LR 131.
And from my perspective as a pediatrician, I have been involved in families who face that news at 18, 20 weeks of gestation, choose to carry to term, as Dr. Harrigan was mentioning, so that they can provide the compassionate care for their child. And that is an impossibly hard decision to even imagine having to make, but just being able to make that decision is a right that we need to protect. I myself have had friends and colleagues who have been put in that position. And it's just devastating, but giving these families the opportunity to meet their baby, to welcome them into the world, to welcome their exit from the world, and to really honor that grieving process is critical. And it's just a right that I feel every person should retain. So
we work with a patient family over in Missoula, Jen and Jameson Banna, who have so generously shared their own story of she learned late on in her pregnancy that her daughter was going to be born with anencephaly without enough of her brain to continue living. And so she was given the option early enough on and said, would you like to terminate your pregnancy or do you want to carry it through? And, for her personal family values, she was like, I want to carry my daughter. I want to feel her growing inside of me. And whatever minutes I have with her, I want those minutes. And so she was able to, and she had only 5 minutes, but they were able to sing the lullaby that they sing to all of their children when they're born. Mm-hmm. Their father was able to bathe Anna the way that the dad is always the one who bathes the kids first in their family. They're able to honor those traditions and have those few moments. And, I always say about how when she tells the story, she doesn't cry telling the story. For her, it's a really beautiful thing that she got to say goodbye to Anna. What makes her cry is the thought of if this had happened after LR 131, if it passed, then she wouldn't say goodbye to her daughter. Anna wouldn't pass away peacefully in her arms. Anna would pass away down a cold hallway, not anywhere near her. And that's what really brings her to tears.
Do you want questions now?
Yeah, we are happy to take whatever questions that people might have about the initiative.
Who pays for it?
Yeah.
The full court press.
I think that is a great question, and that's one of the questions that I raised too. It is extraordinarily expensive to do this, and a lot of times we don't even have the equipment that would be needed to do this. And so it's bringing in, a neonatologist, a full neonatal nursing team, a respiratory therapist. It's a huge team to try to do this for a futile attempt. And so I wouldn't know what the exact cost of that was, but a lot of times it would come back to the taxpayers because oftentimes these are families that are supported by Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And so for all of that, I think it would be, I wouldn't say a waste of money, but it also is. It's a futile use of taxpayer dollars, potentially.
Would it be possible to read the actual text of the bill?
Well,
and I also have how it's listed on the ballot in my...
The initial text in bold says, an act adopting the Born Alive Infant Protection Act, providing that infants born alive, including infants born alive after an abortion, are legal persons requiring health care providers to take necessary actions to preserve the life of a born-alive infant, providing a penalty, providing that the proposed act be submitted to the qualified electors of Montana and providing an effective date. It defines born alive, means the complete expulsion or extraction from the mother of a human infant at any stage of development, who after expulsion or extraction breathes, has a beating heart, or has definite movement of voluntary muscles. It defines a healthcare provider as essentially any hospital employee. It has mandatory reporting. So an employee or a volunteer of a medical facility or abortion clinic that has knowledge of a failure with the medical requirements shall immediately report the failure to law enforcement. So that makes volunteers the ones deciding what's reasonable treatment, potentially. And then the penalty is, that's in here somewhere. Oh, criminal penalties. Healthcare providers who purposely, knowingly, or negligently violate this is guilty of a felony upon conviction shall be fined an amount not to exceed $50,000, be imprisoned in a state prison for a term not to exceed 20 years, or both.
Do you know how they're defining providers?
Healthcare provider means an individual who may be asked to participate in any way in a healthcare service or procedure, including but not limited to a physician, physician's assistant, nurse, nurse's aide, medical assistant, hospital employee, so that's a chaplain, medical facility employee, or abortion clinic employee.
And I was told that even includes environmental services, so people that clean the patient's room could be implicated in this.
Or people that...
Or people that check in patients for services. Yes.
Are there similarly worded bills, or even perhaps nearly word for word, bills of referendums being given time in other states or have already passed or failed?
So Missouri has a similar law. Minnesota has a similar law. Indiana has a similar law. But here's the thing, is that their similar laws are what we already have on our books. So none of those laws go to the extreme that this one does, as far as we've been able to find. And I can say that New Hampshire also had a ballot referendum around this same kind of bill, and they defeated it, I want to say 2021, maybe, the recent past. But yes, so to your answer is, there are born alive laws out there, and they're what Montana already has. And so this just is above and beyond anything that we have come across so far.
And federal law defines born alive as a person. It doesn't mandate this kind of care or reporting.
And you mentioned that it might actually cause more abortions to be done. Now, what happens in those cases? If the parent says, well, I can't face that at the end. I'll choose an abortion now. Mm-hmm. Well, would they actually still have that chance, opportunity?
That's a complicated question. because there are a lot of abortion legislation that is now tied up in court cases with Planned Parenthood. So technically, abortions are allowed in Montana up to viability, and viability is defined as something that a physician defines. Technically, whenever we're talking about viability, we're kind of saying like 22, 23, 24 weeks of gestation. And so, and that is differentiated in a lot of different ways. But, Montana up until this point has had pretty, open abortion laws. And as of right now, we still do. Now, the number of providers that are available in the state to be able to do them is quite limited. And so, a lot of my patients, so for example, if I have a patient come to me at 21 weeks, they just were a little bit late coming in for their anatomy ultrasound, we've actually dialed that back in our office to do them at 18 weeks so that our patients have more options available to them. But if somebody comes in at 21, 22 weeks and we diagnose them with anencephaly, like baby Anna that she was talking about, doesn't have a good portion of the brain, there are only one or two providers in the entire state that are skilled enough to do a termination at that point. So oftentimes, if a patient decides, I don't want to carry to term because of this awful thing that could happen to my baby at term, we oftentimes have to send them to Seattle or Colorado. And so for a lot of our patients that don't have the means to pay for travel, they are then forced to continue the pregnancy to term without having that as an option, just because there's so few providers in Montana that have that skill set. We are working to see if that's something that we can help with, but at the same time, I don't think a patient should have to be forced to make that decision. If they would have normally carried the baby to term so that they could comfort the baby, that should be an option that's available to them.
And I can say that a recent study showed that in terms of abortions that happened after that 20-week mark, only accounted for 0.7% of abortions here in the state of Montana. And again, because they are so very complicated. You know, Representative Matt Regeer and like proponents of this measure, they really want to demonize late-term abortions. And the Compassion for Montana Families coalition that our campaign is a part of is in full support of the full spectrum of reproductive and sexual health care, and that means late-term abortions. And so, you know, the way that this is worded on the ballot was really just to, you know, make a boogeyman of late-term abortions. When the reality is that in Montana, it is where our laws fall, it is a physical impossibility for a viable infant to result from a late-term abortion. It's a physical impossibility in Montana. Yes?
How do you know that? And someone mentioned earlier about, I believe you stated that there, this is a situation that doesn't happen, that infants survive abortions. Where, could you cite that, please?
Repeat the question, will you please?
Yeah, so you were asking if
I could... did one of you state that this is a situation that doesn't happen, that in... babies do not survive abortions?
Mm-hmm. Typically, they do not. Number one, because abortions typically are not performed on viable infants. So babies that are beyond the gestational age of viability, that usually doesn't happen unless there is some sort of lethal anomaly that also accompanies that. So a significant chromosomal abnormality, a significant birth defect, because in general, that's not something that is done in the state.
Well, abortions aren't legal after the point of viability
in the
state
of
Montana.
So it's not something that would happen because they aren't legal beyond the point of viability.
So globally, does it happen? Absolutely, yes. And that's why we have that law on our state books, and that's why we have the federal law as well.
Didn't you say there's flexibility in regards to viability that is determined by the doctor and it can fluctuate from week to week?
I mean, that is how it is stated right now, but in general, whenever we're talking about viability, I think most people would say, you know, 22 to 23 weeks, and certainly, you know, 24 weeks. I think that most of us would have a hard time saying that that's not a point of viability, but it is left up to the discretion of the provider.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think here with regard to this issue of viability. If a fetus came early, say at 20 weeks, so, you know, clearly, probably in the non-viable, is there anything that you can physically do to prolong that life? And what would be required for this thing to pass under those circumstances? What would you
do? 20 weeks?
Within 20 weeks, 19 or 20.
There really isn't anything you can physically do at 20 weeks. You would not be able to get a breathing tube in. You would not. You could try to get lines in. I mean, at 20 weeks, you at this point don't have equipment small enough.
Oh, sorry.
I guess those people have been looking.
Somebody else.
I was just, you know, we're in Bozeman, and so we have doctors and that. Montana has an awful lot of no doctors within any close net. How is that going to be addressed if this passes?
Repeat the question, William.
So it was just, she was asking what happens in areas that don't have a high density of doctors and how that would affect. Are you talking about like things like home births or like midwifery care?
No, I was just, it seems like I hear they don't have doctors in a lot of the rural area, and so you're going to have somebody trying, I can see, getting into trouble because they go ahead and try to help someone, not an abortion or anything, but just try for the viable.
I think to non-medical professionals or perhaps someone who's paramedic EMS, it would be hard to discern viable versus not viable. I think that's a good point to make, that it is not defined in this initiative what a provider is. It's fairly vague. So does that, you know, in effect negate a Good Samaritan policy? You know, I think that's definitely an important point to make. We're lucky to have such strong medical care in this, in Gallatin Valley, and we want to keep it strong.
Yeah.
We want to be able to keep the Dr. Pettits here.
Yeah, we have supporters of our campaign, like, in the smaller communities around the state in the more rural areas who, yeah, don't have a neonatology unit in their backyard, and this is a real concern for them. On multiple levels, obviously.
We have transport teams that go all across the state to provide resuscitation for extremely preterm babies. So we do everything we can. Ideally, if the mom's pregnant, she would come and deliver at a facility that can take care of an extremely preterm baby. And if she's at a facility that can't, then
I think that this...
Do what you can and send help.
Yellowstone Public Radio had an item on the desert, the, what they call it, Dr. Desert, or where they're, as you know, because of distances, that there is just no medical help available. In this case, it was the case they were citing was back in Pennsylvania with a rural area in the Amish community. They call it a medical desert or something anyway.
I just want to make a comment. I'm an obstetrician, and I just want Dr. Pettit to maybe comment a little bit on, and maybe Dr. Harrigan, like, sometimes it's these scenarios that we find where somebody comes in labor at 21 weeks, and there's literally nothing we can do. Maybe 21 and a half weeks, like, we cannot stop it. And I just want also to comment towards the viability question. I mean, these babies, their hearts do beat. Yes. Mm-hmm. They do sometimes make little movements, yes. But there is still the amount of resuscitation and intervention that it would take doesn't exist. And so I would like you to comment, though, on these kiddos, if that was the situation, 21 and 4, perhaps, and one of them is moving and its heart is beating. Like, what are you going to be forced to do if this passes? Or what would you attempt to do? I just want to illustrate what intervention looks like and how disruptive that really is for a family. You know, like, as a provider, just how difficult these decisions are horrible in the best of situations. And this law will make it just that much worse.
Well, right now we would actually offer resuscitation down to 22 weeks if, after discussion with the family, if they thought that that was in their best interest, even though the chances of surviving at 22 weeks are small and there's a high chance for a poor outcome for neurodevelopmental impairment, we would offer down to 22 weeks. And you don't always know exactly what the gestational age of the baby is going to be. So ideally, we'd be able to talk to a family, especially if there was a concern about maybe the baby was more mature and did they want us to be there, and make an assessment of what we could do. So we talked to them. We'd want to know what their values were. Did they think that if there was any chance that they would want us to try to intervene, or they want comfort care because the chances of not surviving are so small?
Interventions mean putting tubes down. And
at 21 and 4/7 weeks, we don't intervene because they don't survive. We would potentially be there if you thought that they might be more mature, and just to take a look. But that resuscitation means putting a breathing tube in. It means putting lines in their umbilical cords. It means potentially pushing on their chest and giving chest compressions. It means giving medications to stimulate the heart. It means weeks and weeks and months, even years in the ICU if they do survive. At least, extreme prematurity.
Being in the incubator for their immature skin and and high risk for infections, and just high interventions.
And these are, you know, sometimes again, like choices that families do make. They want that full court press. And so we're here to, you know, protect that full range of decision-making ability for them.
Absolutely. And we err on the side of, you know, if we err on the side of viability.
Yes.
So this isn't a question, but it's more of a comment. I think that the thing that's really striking to me, independent of how you feel about viability or not, interventions or not, the thing that is really the dangerous point in this bill is the penalties that people could face, and people who have really nothing to do with, potentially nothing to do with the care of these babies. And it really, I think that one of the things that's also concerning is that we don't think about the Pandora's box that we open when one bill goes into effect, right? So this bill focuses on viability and resuscitations for infants, but what the dangerous little thing that they've added in there is the penalty of up to 20 years in prison or $50,000 fine for the person who cleans the room or the secretary at the desk. And you think, where does that end, and what other penalties are going to be placed on different parts of the medical system, and how does this one bill open the doorway to so many other things? And then what, like, is concerning to me is, where do we worry then, who is going to be motivated to become a provider? Sure. Who is going to be motivated to become a nurse or a doctor and take on all those years of training and all that, you know, expense and personal and professional cost that comes with being in this profession, with the thought that whatever I do, right now it's for newborns, but maybe next time it's someone who has a heart attack and doesn't survive. Am I going to be in jail for 20 years because someone determined that I didn't do enough or what they deemed as appropriate or enough? And I think that, I think really, my comment is just that I think we need to take away really the other language, because that really clouds the water, muddies the water, and really focus on the thing that they're sneaking in here kind of quietly, which is the very nefarious and concerning thing for people of all ages, whether you're having kids or not, whether you're concerned about reproductive care or not. But what does it mean for me? Am I going to be able to find a doctor or a nurse practitioner ever because of laws like this? And I think that's a conversation that we can have that really isn't charged, because these things, I think, as a way to, I see it as a way to sneak in different laws, because we shroud it in things that are very charged emotionally, politically, but then we don't think about the undercurrent and what happens with these other pieces to the law. And I think that can be a conversation that we can all relate to and be really concerned about, which we should all really be concerned about. And that is something that will be pervasive through medical care for a lifetime. And that, to me, is where I feel really, really scared for the future of our medical system. It's like, these penalties. Why would anyone ever work at a hospital or in a medical clinic? Why would you work as a, you know, why would you get a job as a receptionist? Why would you get a job at the front door? Why would you get a job in environmental services and not at Costco? Like, you know, because at Costco I don't have to worry about 20 years in jail because I cleaned the room of a baby that didn't survive a resuscitation. That, to me, is terrifying, and I think we should all be really concerned about that. If nothing else, you know.
Not if you're criminalizing medicine.
Yeah, exactly. Criminalizing medicine is a really dangerous path to go on, and this is the first step. And I think, if nothing else, we can forget all the other language and really just focus on that and take away the emotion that's behind the language of the other part of the bill and think about the damage that is going to be done the way that this bill is structured.
And we have an open letter that a maternal fetal subspecialist over in Missoula put together and disseminated to colleagues around the state. And more than 700 healthcare providers, you know, physicians, nurse practitioners, everyone has signed on to this bill, not just, you know, OBs and neonatologists, et cetera, because, again, they see that slippery slope. And they say, you know, if we are criminalizing medical healthcare here, what are we going to criminalize next? What's going to be next? And then, we're also working with a palliative care physician, and she has the same questions about, you know, if we cannot let our most vulnerable. Infants pass away comfortably with respectful palliative care. Then who comes next? Mm-hmm. Who next is undeserving of passing away in the loving arms of their family members, you know? Yes.
The last couple questions are kind of lead into mine. Neither 167 nor 131 define medically appropriate and reasonable care and treatment. So what is it, and who decides what it is?
According to 167, it could be a volunteer at the hospital is mandated to report you if they think it's not reasonable.
Because it doesn't say otherwise.
And it's obvious that it affects the hospital, but it would affect babies born, home births, and midwives.
Yeah, what happens
so
home
it could
birth?
Be a neighbor coming in right. to a home birth, or a child, or
literally anybody. Yeah.
And you do, I mean, I'm not sure, but you do deal with people who are with midwives or have some connection with them in home births in case something
Absolutely.
Maybe not appearing to go well. So
those
you can draw
patients
in.
Do come to the hospital or...
Yeah, I mean, we see them a lot with, you know, failed home birth that need to come in and have an epidural or they want to come in and have... a cesarean section, they probably get admissions to the NICU that are from home births of babies that are not thriving.
Yeah.
So certainly they do enter into the hospital system, for sure.
Thank you. Do you have
just wanted to make sure I wasn't cutting anybody else off. I know I've been asking a lot of questions. I have kind of in a different perspective on it. I'm a Montana licensed and nationally registered emergency medical technician. So I see an aspect to it that maybe hasn't been looked at as much in that if you look at the actual text of the bill, it says an infant born alive is a legal person for all purposes under the laws of the state and is entitled to the protections of the laws, including the right to appropriate and reasonable medical care and treatment. It appears that the law is just clarifying that anyone born alive deserves the same protections that everyone else has. And is that not the reason that we have state and county protocols that determine what is that appropriate and reasonable medical care and treatment? Not creating anything else, but ensuring that this will be followed. And if I was allowed to comment, which I'm not sure with it being public forum, what's allowed and what's not, I believe I could clarify the reasoning for why some of this is necessary in that it has happened. Why should someone else have to be a mandatory reporter? Is it not like if you witness child abuse, not asking you to be the determining person of what's appropriate and reasonable medical care, but if there's obvious abuse and neglect, whether it's mandatory or not, I would hope that we would all want to say something about that. And unfortunately, this has happened. I have spoken with those who have survived abortions and other circumstances and who have survived when doctors told the parents there was no chance that they would. And so I just ask you to consider that appropriate and reasonable medical care should be something that we are all entitled to, regardless of the circumstances. And that doesn't necessarily have to mean that you can't make decisions that are appropriate to you as a family, but in regards to how invasive the procedures are, sometimes that's part of emergency medicine and it may be worth it in the end. So that's my question to you is, would you consider that everyone is worth a chance to save?
Well, we absolutely should, and again, that's why we have state federal laws that say exactly that.
They're already there.
There are, and I don't know any provider, I mean, sorry to... I don't know any provider that gets into any avenue of care because they want anyone to suffer undue harm or, you know, abuse or anything. So I just...
I've never met a single individual in any level of care, whether it's nurse to medical assistant to the person who checks you in at the front desk of your medical office. Like, not one person goes into that field because they think, gosh, this is a great way for me to just really abuse people and not give good care. So I just think that that's the cornerstone of medical career is, or a medical career is that your oath is to do no harm and to give care in a respectful, compassionate, appropriate manner to the best of your knowledge and ability. And so I think that everyone caring for a family is working towards the same goal, which is just happy, healthy families in the best way that we can do it, regardless of the situation. Sometimes situations are just so tragic. And yeah.
Let's hear from our Pam.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I mean, I don't want to say like insulting to healthcare providers, but it is, because we went to school for a long time to make human lives better. I don't think any one of us, being a nurse, a physician, anybody that works in a medical setting, like, nobody goes into it to be like, I want to prolong life. I want to make people healthier. I want to make human existence better. But whenever you have a situation in which you know that there is no way that you can improve that situation, you know that that baby's going to pass away no matter what you do, I think it's also our job to take a step back and just say, you know what, we need to talk to the family, we need to decide what, you know, their values are. And sometimes the most compassionate and the most medically appropriate thing is to have compassion care and palliative care, because we can't save every single baby that's conceived. We can't save every single baby that's born. And I think that that is what is dangerous about this bill. It's making it to where we aren't able to use any type of medical judgment to help educate our patients and families, because they are looking to us oftentimes to tell them, like, what does this mean? What does this look for, like, for my baby long term? If my baby did have all of this aggressive care, would my baby ever come out of the hospital? Would my baby ever be able to go to school? And I think that those are questions that we don't know the exact answer to, but we know from really, really good population data, we know from our years of training what that looks like. And I think it's our job not to make decisions for families. It is never us telling families what they should or have to do, but it's our job to provide them with information. We can, whenever I talk to a family that I diagnose with a really horrible birth defect, I give them the full range of what could happen. And I always say, I wish I had a crystal ball so I could tell you exactly how this is going to go. But every single wife is different. Every single situation is different. And my job is to give them as much information as I can provide. And if I can't provide it, I have them talk to other people that are more expert in that. So I have them talk to Dr. Pettit so that she can tell them about what that neonatal care would potentially look like. I have them talk to pediatricians that talk about kind of the long-term child care that might be involved in that. I don't think any healthcare provider makes a decision about whether or not a baby lives or dies in by themselves. You have a team of healthcare providers. You have that family telling you what their desires are. And it's never just one person making that decision. And so there's a huge safety net for this to determine what is viable, what is not viable. And honestly, the family usually directs that conversation and those decisions for us. And so it's not just one person that is making these decisions that could make a bad decision, because there's a lot of people going into the care of these families to give them the information that we need. And so, I mean, as healthcare providers, we are just trying to give families the information and the education that we have to the best of our ability. And then we're allowing them to be able to make the decision that's best for their family, which is different for every family, but they should be able to make that decision. They should have that decision available.
One of the patients that we're working with, you know, her infant was born quite early, and they were like full court press, like, let's go. And so for a couple of weeks, that infant like stayed in the NICU and got the full court press, and like every day was improving until suddenly it wasn't. And suddenly they went from talking about, you know, like, do you think she's going to like soccer, to do you think she's ever going to be able to breathe on her own? Mm-hmm. And then she just, her condition worsened and worsened, and she was pulling out her own intubation tube. Mm-hmm. She wasn't, nothing that they were doing was working. And, you know, the mom talks about how, you know, like for that short time, for those few weeks, she was all like, my number one job as a parent is to love my daughter and to keep her safe and make her feel loved and protected every step of the way. And at some point, all of these invasive measures that weren't working in the end were no longer making her feel like she was keeping her daughter safe. And her number one job was to love and protect her daughter. And so she made the decision of, I want to honor my daughter. I want her to pass away peacefully with pain management care, as opposed to all of these invasive procedures that they knew were not just not working, but they were, you know, bruising her daughter and hurting her daughter. And she was like, if we had continued down that road, then I wouldn't have been able to, you know, hold my daughter peacefully in the sunshine. I would have been handed a broken and bruised body, and that's not what she wanted.
Quickly, just what is interesting about Montana laws, so we do have these laws that already protect the right to life. Mm-hmm. And that includes me being able to make a choice at the end of my life.
Correct.
And these people are stepping in and trying to take that all away from us at that level and our own level. It could relate to...
Mm-hmm. Well, I was talking to a friend at my daughter's soccer practice, and I actually, you know, she is very, very pro-life, and she... would never ever choose an abortion for herself or anything like that. But, you know, I was talking to her about this, and she couldn't believe that somebody was taking away her ability to be able to, like, baptize her baby, to be able to care for her baby. She was like, I feel like that the way that it's written is very misleading, because it makes it sound like I need to vote yes because I'm helping to preserve lives of babies. But she's like, the way that you're explaining it makes me realize that it's not about that at all. It's about taking away my decision, to be able to decide what I would want to do. And she likened that to, you know, a child diagnosed with cancer or something like that, and deciding, do you want 3 good months and that's all you get with your child, or do you want 6 months of chemotherapy where your child is incredibly ill, but at the end it's the same thing, your child passes away? She's like, we can make a decision to do that for our child, but we can't do it at the beginning of their life. And she was like, is there not a thing where you can sign like a do not resuscitate for your fetus? And I said, there's not at this point. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a slippery slope. Like, if you can do that whenever you're a grown up, and you can actually do that for your child if they're 3 or 4 years old, it's hard to imagine that we aren't allowed to do that for a baby that is not going to survive, but we are forced to do things for them.
So. And in the very few interviews that Representative Revere has agreed to on this measure, you know, sometimes like when he reads our stories where we share of, you know, these providers' expertise, where we talk about our patients and what they went through, you know, he said like, oh, like that, there'll be an exception for that, you know, like that doesn't count. But there is not a single exception anywhere in this law as it stands right now, not a single one. So yeah, there's all this nuance. And
And I feel like the public just doesn't understand what they're actually voting for. And so we encourage everybody, like, whenever you're out talking to people, you know, just remind people, like, a no vote doesn't mean that you don't love babies, and that you like, a no vote means that families are able to decide what they would like to have happen with their babies. And so it feels really wrong to vote no for something that says, like, you know, born alive babies. Everybody supports born alive babies, but we support born alive babies that have a chance of like having a normal life, not born alive babies that are potentially never, you know, they're not going to survive.
Are there any particular websites that doctors have put together, or someone has put together with a lot of doctor signatures and statements that summarize some of the things we've said that we could, you know, print off and talk to friends about and that kind of thing?
Yeah, so our website is no, LR131.org, and there are pages on a page on there with perspectives of healthcare providers of these some of these families that I've been talking about today. And so there's that. And then out in the hallway at the table, I also have some informational pieces about LR131 as well. The letter that I mentioned with the more than 700 signatures, that just wrapped up, last night. And so it's going to become a full-page newspaper ad here in the weeks to come, and it will also be up on our website in time, so you can see that full list of 700 names of trusted healthcare providers.
And the Montana Medical Association, like basically anything that represents healthcare providers, they've all released statements saying that they do not support this. And Montana Medical Association actually has a full webpage dedicated to why this is not something that should be passed.
The MMA, and then also the Montana chapter of the
American Academy of Pediatrics.
Yes. And then also the Montana chapter of ACOG, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology.
And there's a great guest column today in the Chronicle.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes. I just have a comment. I'm an OBGYN as well, practicing in the community, and I think really it's such a hot topic, right, abortion. Whether we agree or don't agree with abortion, I think the conversation, as you're having these conversations with people in the community, should really be about our constitutional right to privacy. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, you know, if you live in Montana, our Constitution protects us, and we have the right to privacy. We have the right to make medical decisions that are made between ourselves and our physicians. And nobody gets to make those decisions for us. We get to make them with our physicians, right? And so this bill, or this referendum, is asking every voter in Montana, 18 and over, who can vote, to have a seat at the table and sit there and listen in on a private conversation that you're having with your physician and make that decision for you. And that's not appropriate. And speaking of Pandora's box, slippery slope, you know, interfering with your end-of-life decisions, it is going to interfere with that. I mean, this is sort of this precedent where, well, you know, they can tell you what to do with your body, and you know, and now we're going to say that no, you can't decline chemotherapy for your breast cancer. You have to. If it can help you live another year, you have to do it. Everyone vote on it and decide. It's not okay. So we have the right to privacy in this state, and I hope we continue to enjoy that right to privacy. And that's where you need to shift the conversation. It's not about you, someone who's pro-life. They're going to be pro-life. Someone who's anti-choice or whatever, someone who's pro-choice, they're always going to be pro-choice. You can't win that argument, really. But we can all agree, we have the right to privacy, and that's going to be taken away. If you say yes to this, you're going to lose it. You're going to lose your right to make a decision about your child who needs chemotherapy, or your child who, you know, needs a life-saving, you know, whatever procedure, or not. You know, you don't get to make that decision. Someone's going to make it for you. We get to make our own decisions. You know, so anyway, that's my comment.
Thank you.
And we're proud that our campaign is very much like nonpartisan and has supporters from across the ideological base, because again, while our coalition, Compassion for Montana Families, is in full support of the full spectrum of reproductive and sexual health, we understand that this affects everyone, no matter where you stand on access to abortion. And so we're really proud to have those partners who they themselves would not choose abortion, but they themselves want that private decision-making ability.
One more for you.
In speaking of privacy and the decisions that you make, are you the one making it for the baby? Who is making the decisions, and would it be considered an invasion of privacy to report child abuse? Parents do not always make the best decisions. Is it an invasion of privacy to report that, or for law enforcement to step in and take care of that child? That's also something to consider. If you look at the actual wording of the law, appropriate and reasonable medical care does not mandate that all these things have to be done. They could be the best option, perhaps they're not. Just like end-of-life care, it's a very complicated issue and needs to be a comprehensive decision, very informed, as you stated, with all the information you can help provide the family, but clarifying that this is a person under the law. Each baby born alive has all the rights of another person, and if a parent decides that they don't have those rights,
that there's federal law since 2002
that states if you're born with a heartbeat, if you're born with movement, if you're born with respiratory effort, that you are a person. And yes, we are mandated reporters if there is child abuse or if a parent's making a decision that is clearly not in their child's best interest. We are mandated reporters, and that does go against privacy. But this goes to a deeper level of asking people to decide what's reasonable to report on things that they have no knowledge base about or no.
Because what one person decides is reasonable and appropriate may be totally different for somebody else. And it may be somebody that's reporting that is a visitor at the hospital, somebody that's not involved in medical care at all, and they can report it just as much as somebody that's really highly educated, like a doctor or a nurse. And so there's no boundaries associated with that.
And it really does violate what currently would be considered the standard of care, which is offering compassionate care. It's not forcing compassionate care. Mm-hmm. It is offering compassionate care and allowing families to make an informed decision.
Suppose you have an infant that really isn't viable, and the parents say, do a full card press, that's what I want, even if you look at it and say it's ridiculous. What happens? Do you do it anyway?
You talk to the family.
Yeah.
And you talk to the family.
Yeah.
And you get an ethics consult.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you get another opinion. And you sometimes, if it's unclear, you err on the. I can recall, we didn't know, and so you err on the side of intervening until it's more clear. But sometimes you can be there and mm-hmm. say, this baby's too small, I can't offer.
And I will say, like, from an obstetrical standpoint, we are always err on the side of having our neonatal colleagues there. So if we are having a baby that's born at what we consider a perivival, which means somewhere in that, like, 20 to 24, 25-week range, or somebody that we just don't even know, we always have our neonatal colleagues come in and do an assessment of how far along they think this baby is. Do they think that this baby is able to be resuscitated physically? So we never err on the side of just assuming anything. We always bring in other colleagues.
And I do want to say that I appreciate that you're looking at this with such nuance. And again, like, that's something that Representative Matt Regeer, when he put this together, should have put that in there. You know, because right now it is black and white, you know, and black and white is not going to do anyone any favors looking at this bill, you know. And so yeah, like, I appreciate your push for nuance, and unfortunately that is not what's in front of us.
And I say, we just went through, you know, so medically mandating vaccines is not something we do. We don't mandate masks. And that was hard, but I had to respect other people's decision to not get a vaccine or not wear a mask. I did not want that to be made law. And then all of a sudden it was made law that you didn't have to do it, which was so strange. And that an employer couldn't force you to wear a mask or make the choice. But yeah, we're wandering kind of into this place, like you were talking about, where we're not getting to make these choices. And that, just those absolutes are always kind of dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Part of this discussion that also bothered me was that the parents are making the decision for the infant. Now, the infant can't make that decision.
Right.
But I would much rather that the parents and the doctor make that decision than the government.
And again, just pushing that's a team effort. And you have loving parents making that decision, and you have medical experts weighing in on that as well. And so, you know, no one's going to fall through the cracks with all the folks at hand.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think that's
it. Thank you.
That concludes the portion of the issue forum concerning LR 131, the Medical Care Requirements for Born Alive Infants Measure. This forum was held at the Bozeman Public Safety Center on October 12, 2022. KGVM does not endorse any candidate or take a particular position on any ballot issue. We strive to disseminate available information to help voters make informed decisions.